You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Joshua Ferris, the best-selling author of three novels, Then We Came to the End, The Unnamed, and To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. He was a finalist for the National Book Award, winner of the Barnes & Noble Discovery Award and the Penn Hemingway Award, and was named one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 writers in 2010. His fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, Tin House, and Best American Short Stories. He lives in New York. Here's a brief summary of Joshua's new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, published by Little Brown & Company. Paul O'Rourke is a man made of contradictions. He loves the world but doesn't know how to live in it. He's a Luddite, addicted to his iPhone, a dentist with a nicotine habit, a rabid Red Sox fan devastated by their victories, and an atheist not quite willing to let go of God. Then someone begins to impersonate Paul online, and he watches in horror as a website, a Facebook page, and a Twitter account are created in his name. What begins as an outrageous violation of his privacy soon becomes something more soul-frightening, the possibility that the online Paul might be a better version of the real thing. As Paul's quest to learn why his identity has been stolen deepens, he is forced to confront his troubled past and his uncertain future in a life disturbingly split between the real and the virtual. At once laugh-out-loud funny about the absurdities of the modern world and indelibly profound about the eternal questions of the meaning of life, love, and truth, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour is a deeply moving and constantly surprising tour de force. I spoke with Joshua Ferris by phone a couple of weeks ago. Why are there so few books about dentists? When I started reading this, I was thinking about it, and I realized I've only ever read two books where the protagonist is a dentist. This one and Jane Smiley's The Age of Grief. Have you ever thought about that before?
The Jane Smiley book is a surprise to me. I've never heard of it. So
it's a novella, and it's a beautiful novella. Yeah. Anyway, just so many books about doctors and lawyers and investigators, but it was great to read about a dentist. So
the other big one, I guess, is McTeague, the Frank Norris book, which was written around at the turn of the century. I guess they just don't make the most obvious heroes or even anti-heroes. I mean, you go in, you get fixed up, and you kind of flee.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to spend a whole lot of time thinking about what just happened back there.
Right, yeah.
And you know, most people just don't like to even be in the office, so they don't want to spend, you know, say 4 years or 3 or 4 years, the time it takes to write a book, being in that sort of space, you know, and mental space, and thinking about themselves in the physical space. So there's probably a lot to overcome when thinking about it, and it's kind of unpleasant.
Yeah, it's such rich material, though, for a character development. I don't know. I just thought it was wonderful. It's funny. When I went to my dentist several years ago, and she had put in these new cameras where you, as a patient, could watch what they were doing in your mouth. And she said, "What do you think of that?" And I said, "I think it's obscene." And she seemed so offended. But it's true. People don't really want to think about what's going on at the dentist.
No, but you're right. It's got so many rich possibilities. And that was really what was so convincing as I was thinking about the character. You know, people come in with accidents and with, you know, rot and decay, and also sort of, you know, they carry in the baggage of their lives, their, you know, how they look and how they feel, and it's all sort of centered right there in the mouth.
Right.
And it really gave me access to things that I wanted to talk about: mortality, sickness, the meaning of life, things that could become immediate by patients that would come in and see my dentist narrator.
Yeah, and I loved some of the stuff that you came up with, and I'm sure some of that was maybe done through research and figuring out exactly what it is that dentists do, but so much of it just seemed like, yes, this is exactly what he would be thinking. We'll talk more about it. So the book concerns Paul O'Rourke. I wondered how you encountered Paul
Did you know who he was going to be before you began the book, or did you have to work really hard to find his character as you wrote?
Yeah, definitely the latter.
Yeah.
It didn't come naturally. I wanted to write initially about like a secret history of a religion that no one really knew about, was heavily persecuted and just obscure. And I didn't really know how to go about that, so I sort of did a couple of different ways, and they were never very satisfactory. And then when I kind of ditched earlier drafts, I started thinking about what was just sort of more compelling. And I came up with the dentist because, in part of the reasons that I just said, but also because he had a lot of things to do. You know, he sort of came alive once he had a profession. Mm. And the voice started to come. And then I folded in the story of the religion as a sort of secondary strain or theme or narrative.
Yeah.
And when those two things came together and worked in tandem, then I had the novel. But it really took a long time to arrive at those two things.
Okay. I want to talk about the religion, but before we get there, I want to ask you another little bit about creating Paul O'Rourke's character. I thought it was really interesting that you present, I think it's about 8 to 10 pages at the beginning of the book, from Paul's point of view and in his narrative point of view. And these are pages in which he speaks to the reader about his life. But then about 10 pages in, you come to the sentence, "My name is Paul O'Rourke." Why did you introduce us to Paul in this way? I really enjoyed that. And that sentence kind of jumped out at me. It was just like, oh, now I know so much about him, and yet now is when I meet him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. It's an interesting question because it came late. That paragraph came late where he just sort of says very basic biographical information. I think that for those first 8 or 10 pages that you point out, you're getting things that are far more psychological. They're kind of deep in his psyche. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a reader, you like that. I think readers want to know what's going on inside the head of the characters. But there's also an entirely different register that a novelist can hit that says, you know, here's sort of the way in which the world knows me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not you, reader, who I'm inviting to delve deep into my psychological, you know, baggage, but here's sort of the way in which my patients know me, or superficially, here's how I'm known. And I think that those two registers, when put in tandem, give you a really full sense of a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think, too, that goes along very well with his being a dentist, because he's very busy a lot of the time, but he has a lot of time to be in his own head as well, and so he can think about himself and his life and present that to us while he's working as a dentist. I don't know if that's what was happening in those first 8 pages. I can't remember, but okay. So, Joshua, can you read from "To Rise Again at a Decent Hour"?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. Connie was a big one for Googling things. It helped out enormously with all sorts of crises and brought relief to the most pressing concerns. At a restaurant, the two of us would momentarily forget the difference between rigatoni and penne, and she would Google "difference between rigatoni and penne" and provide us the answer. We no longer had to listen to the idiosyncratic replies of the waitstaff on the differences between rigatoni and penne, which were always so full of human approximations and stabs at essences. We had hard definitions straight from the me machine. Or while we were drinking our wine, I might ask Connie, who knew more about wine than I did, "Do white wines need time to breathe like red wines?" She wouldn't know the answer, or had known it at one time but had forgotten it and now needed to know it again very badly, so she'd look it up right then and there at the dinner table while I waited, and learned not only about aeration effects on white wines, but also quite a lot about grapes, tannins, and oxidation techniques, random snippets of which, with her eyes cast down on the phone, she would share with me across the table, distractedly and never coherently. She'd also forget who starred in what, who sang this or that, and if so-and-so was still dating so-and-so. And for those things, too, she'd abandon our conversation to secure the answer. She no longer lived in a world of speculation or recall, and would take nothing on faith when the facts were but a few clicks away. It drove me nuts. I was sick to death of having as my dinner companions Wikipedia, About.com, IMDb, The Zagat Guide, Time Out New York, 100 Tumblrs, The New York Times, and People Magazine. Was there not some strange forgotten pleasure in reveling in our ignorance? Couldn't we just be wrong? We fought about that me machine more than we fought about where to go and what to do. Sex and its frequency, my so-called addiction to the Red Sox, and a million other things combined. With the exception of kids, we fought most about having kids. I'd had enough, and I would say things like, the moon is really just a weak star, or flour tortillas have ganja in them, or my favorite Sean Penn movie is Forrest Gump, and then really dig in until she'd Google it and waggle the screen before my eyes as if the thing itself were saying, nah, 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 nah. And I'd say, Tom Hanks, my butt, it was Sean Penn. And she'd say, it's right here, look, Tom Hanks. And I'd say, I can't believe you needed the internet for that. And the night would descend from there.
Thank you very much for reading that. Okay. I loved the meme machine. It's funny because the references first put into the text without any explanation. It's just put in there as though you had said, you know, computer or device or phone. You call it the meme machine. And I knew exactly what you were talking about right away. And throughout the book, Paul talks about people on their meme machines. So that was great. I also really related to how very badly they have to look things up immediately, or she does. Although he kind of gets to that point too at some point. But
Well, that's sort of an epidemic sweeping the nation.
It is. It's terrible. So your own take on the internet and social media and this sort of stuff that Paul's reflecting on, was he channeling you, or do you feel like he's over the top with this, or what are your thoughts on this?
Well, he's confused, I think, probably in the same way that I am. I mean, it's hard to sort of make sense of it all because it's such an overwhelming phenomenon. You know, I find myself needing to get off of it in order to get work done, and yet drawn back. So I get the appeal, the allure for sure, but I also, you know, feel kind of deeply ambivalent about it. So I like to take long vacations from it and to sort of restrict my usage, you know, sort of in a self-disciplined sort of way. But, you know, like him, I'm continually drawn back. So I have a lot of ambivalence toward it.
Yeah. I really enjoyed, first of all, I'll just say that the book is often very, very funny. And I think this has to do in part with the narrator's conversational tone. And I'm wondering if you agree, and if you do agree, if you find this to be an easier way into humor through this sort of conversational tone.
Yeah, he's certainly very, he's a personable guy, but he's a very vexed man. So... Mm-hmm. It was really important to me that the raised fists at the world that he's got sort of triggered at all times was made palatable by comedy, really. Something more clearly human and winning that would offset some of the more, you know, aggrieved sense. And I think that was just a matter, in terms of writing it, of hitting these registers that, you know, you pointed out. You know, at one point he may be very deep in his own psychology, and then at another moment in time to sort of reveal what his name is and some basic biographical facts. I think that was the same thing operating. I wanted to get at some very difficult truths. I wanted to, you know, expose him, make him feel very aggrieved and existentially lost and at odds with nearly everything in his life. And yet at the same time, for me, as I'm writing it, I don't want to alienate the reader. So I want to make sure to add in these more conversational and humorous things that, you know, soften him a bit and make him a sympathetic character, an understandable character, even as he's, you know, really just not congruent with many things in the world.
Right. Yeah. And that brings me back to the whole conversation about the internet and social media and his reaction to it, and how funny he can be sometimes. There was this one moment that just was so perfect. He already feels like an outsider because he doesn't like to do some of the things that everyone else seems to like to do, such as boating and tanning are two of the things he says. And now he has to read about boating and tanning online, and he says, I was already at one remove before the internet came along. I need another remove. Now I have to spend the time that I'm not doing the thing they're doing, reading about them doing it. It just was so perfect and so funny, and it just, I thought, really crystallized where he's coming from, that moment in the book.
Yeah, a little later he says, you know, the disconnected get more disconnected as the connected get more connected.
Yeah.
Way that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
I also felt like you were tying together technology and mortality when you were presenting information about his perspectives on the internet and things like that. Like, for example, he tapes baseball games onto an old VCR, you know, and it's clear that he's kind of ambivalent about the new technology. For me, that was very tied into his feelings about mortality and about aging and being left behind. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that aspect of it.
Yeah, for sure. They're connected. And I think I would add just that religion is connected to that too. So the internet, mortality, and religion here are all kind of bound up with one another. Mm-hmm. I think the most immediate thing to recognize is that technology has its allure mainly because it serves as a distraction. It serves as a distraction from thoughts of death, but mm-hmm. it also serves as a distraction from thoughts of what to do with our time. Before the internet came along, we might turn on the TV, we might less likely go for a walk or do something like that. Now that we have the world in our hands, we never really need to wonder what we need to do with our time. We just spend it on there. And, you know, it's often remarked that people waste a lot of time online. It's really meant, more than anything, just to sort of relieve anyone of the anxiety of having to think about how one should spend one's time on Earth.
Yeah, it's like a jittery addiction. You just go to it without even trying to think about what else you should be doing. It's just what you reach for.
It's extremely relieving. It's just a very, it soothes.
Mm.
And I think that aspect that is so very addictive obscures some of the great challenges that we face as individual souls. What we should be doing, how we should conduct ourselves in the limited time that we have on Earth. And, you know, to some extent, it replaces religion. You don't really need to have overarching reassurances of the next life when you are constantly distracted by the goodies on offer here in this one.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these things I was thinking about just sort of as a human being and wanted to, you know, talk about them within the book, but it wouldn't have been quite as significant, I think, were it not for, you know, Paul's need for something greater. So he had to be kind of aggrieved about the internet to some extent, but also attracted to it, vexed in this way, in order to sort of figure out finally how he might be misconducting his life, his world, and how there might be a greater possibility out there for him.
And I enjoyed the fact that the thing that he feels is missing, he tries to fill in unexpected ways. You know, I mean, he's kind of an avowed atheist at the beginning of the book. He's not looking to fill that void with God. He's looking to fill it with golf. He's looking to fill it with, I can't remember, going to the gym, lifting weights. I enjoyed that he was just like so focused on trying to find the thing that's missing. I wondered, did Paul get into your head while you were writing the novel? Did he, when you weren't actually working, was he there with you? And did he sort of, I find sometimes that this happens anyway, and I just thought Paul might be the kind of character that would do more of this than another character, just sort of be there narrating your life as you're working, as you're walking through your day. Did that happen at all?
Yeah, what was interesting is that I would see certain things through his point of view.
Yeah.
out in the world and suddenly need to write them from his point of view, you know.
Okay.
So that I, you know, say I would see some silly headline on a celebrity magazine, I couldn't just look at it as if it were me and sort of enjoy, because I really enjoy reading celebrity magazines. I get a great kick out of them. I couldn't read them just as myself now, where I sort of lost myself to the travails of Chris and Gwyneth or something like that. I really had to sort of like send them up and point out their absurdities. And so I would suddenly find myself writing things from his perspective, not reading the magazine anymore, just writing. And then some of those things I never even incorporated into the novel. So they really did sort of capture me and demand that I sort of filter it through him and get it down on the page, whether or not I'd use it or, you know, I just had to get it down.
All right, so Paul, a big part of this book is that Paul has his identity stolen, in that a website and a Facebook page and a Twitter account all sort of appear on the internet espousing opinions in his name, but, you know, he swears he has not created these accounts, he has not written these things. And I thought this was such a brilliant move to put this character and his, who's already feeling somewhat powerless in his world, put him in this situation. I was wondering, of course, if you've ever had an experience like this, and if you know people who have, or if it was just something that you've read about and you decided to do research and put Paul in this situation.
Well, to some extent, I think we can all kind of understand what it's like, not necessarily to have our identity stolen, but to have our identity formed on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, you're always kind of curating your own Facebook page and Twitter account, and you want to sort of present the world with the best, most winning version of you possible. Mm-hmm. But then something might come into play, somebody else saying something. I mean, we hear a lot about this with respect to bullying and, you know, kids in school and things that are a little bit at a remove. But if you hear something that doesn't quite jibe with your understanding of the world, then you suddenly realize that the internet has a way of forming things, of shaping things that are quite out of your control. And it's that loss of control, and especially when it's sort of pointed very decidedly at you or your personality or your Facebook page or whatever it may be, when you recognize that it can be a kind of totalitarian form of control, because you really don't have any. I mean, you can speak back, you can speak out about it, but it's such an indelible form right now. The pages last forever, and it's very difficult to get them down. So what is spoken about you, what is created about you and your identity gets shaped in ways that I don't think you have control over. So that's really what I was thinking about when Paul's identity gets stolen, more than an actual identity theft.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think, for an author's perspective, of, you know, the ease of writing book reviews now, and the way that you know, anybody who goes to Amazon might read six things about your book, and depending on the reader and how discerning that reader is, those six things might have equal weight in their mind. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, Amazon, the reviews on Amazon can be something like 1 star for the book jacket arriving dirtied.
Right.
You know,
right.
I give this one, I haven't read it yet, the reviewer will say, but it arrived 3 days late with a dirty dust jacket that was partly torn, and so I'm giving this only 1 star. So it's really a reflection of Amazon or, you know, UPS or something very distinct from the writer's, you know, final product.
Yeah.
And it really sort of, it's like the widgetization of the book. And it can be very upsetting. But you don't have control. And I think that's really what I was interested in more than anything. We so often think we're in complete control over everything. And here's a guy who does recognize, because he sees patients every day who have no control over their mouths, some of whom do because they fail to floss, but some of them don't because of an accident or bad genes or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. He's aware that we don't have a lot of control, but then something about his identity, the thing he thinks he has, perhaps the one thing he thinks he has control over, is gone. And it sends him into a real crisis.
Yeah, yeah. What you just said about his practice of dentistry and the way that he recognizes that some people have control and some people don't. Do you mind if I read a short section that I just thought was so beautiful? Is that okay with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. He's talking about the people that come to him for dental work. They wanted whiter smiles, straighter smiles, less gummy smiles, gum bleachings and lip repositioning, smiles whose architecture was remade tooth by tooth, millimeter by millimeter, until every bad memory from childhood had been eradicated. They wanted George Clooney's smile or Kim Kardashian's smile or that beefy knock-kneed smile of Tom Cruise's, and they brought in clippings of lesser celebrities whose smiles they hoped I could give them so that they too could smile like celebrities and walk the streets like celebrities and live forever and ever in the glow of celebrity. These were patients who could afford to indulge themselves, lawyers and hedge fund managers and their spouses who had no more appetite for imperfection, and socialites who made the rounds of museum galas, catching the light at every flash. And then, in contrast, there were those who, with no insurance, came in from complications, from a self-pulled tooth yanked with pliers in the kitchen of a rent-controlled walk-up after putting away half a bottle of Jim Beam. I read that out loud to my husband. I thought, oh my God, this is so perfect, so beautiful. So first I just wanted to say that it just really struck me as just such a perfect description of what he would see in his line of work. And then also I wanted to ask you about your use of detail and your suggestions for writers who you know are writing, and you know that rent-controlled walk-up and that half bottle of Jim Beam and those pliers, you know, those sorts of details I think are what speaks to us when we read a section like that. I just wonder if we could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, if you, there's a way of kind of getting deeper with your character that doesn't come immediately, I don't think. So if you're talking about some guy driving down the road, you could simply write, he was driving down the road. Mm-hmm. Or you can write that sentence, and that's sort of a perfectly fine sentence because it explains what it is that your character's doing. But there's a way of sort of getting more, I don't know, sublimating certain facts and then revealing them through more sophisticated means, so that you might say, his eyes swept the road in front of him. As the car barreled down the highway or something like that, so that you kind of go in closer. I mean, the metaphor might be one from the movies where the camera just sort of swoops in a little bit closer and becomes more more focused. And I think that the idea here is that, you know, I could conceive of someone, and we've had a lot of talk about healthcare in this country, and we have a lot of people without it, and dental problems kind of go, they fall by the wayside. They're second thoughts, really. They're not as immediate as medical problems, and yet at the same time they're extremely bad when they you know, break out into the open. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking this clearly happens where people wait for a long time to take care of themselves. Then something terrible happens. They can't afford it. So how do they solve it? And so if I'm thinking about this in general terms like that, then I start to get, you know, I set them down. I think about them. They exist as problems, and then I refine them. You know, I come back to them and I think, well, what are the particulars? And then the particulars start to emerge over the course of, you know, some morning or, you know, a couple of mornings, and then they do crystallize, and they crystallize in ways that I'm not sure how to articulate, except I'm just thinking about them. You know, I'm trying to get ever more refined in ways that will really bring home the possibility of this particular situation.
And as you consider the details of a certain thing that you're trying to describe, will you get so focused on it that you might change that Jim Beam to some other liquor? I mean, like, will you try to make it that perfect, or does it just sort of flow for you once you realize this is the detail I want to use? You know, it's it's a bottle of something.
I think at a certain point, you can refine so much that it becomes, it starts to look artificial.
Mm-hmm.
I ran across, as I was driving into Milwaukee today, I ran across last night when I was driving into Milwaukee, I saw this beer I had never seen before. It was a truck. It was a distributor truck. And I'd never seen that beer before. And I thought, well, that's an interesting beer to put into, you know, something that I'm writing to make it more authentic. But in fact, it would sound made up. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody's heard of it before. So there's a way of kind of getting ever more refined that's all of a sudden starts to bleach the sentence and the thought of, I don't know, sincerity or the texture of realness.
Right.
And you're left with kind of something that looks just a little too sublimated.
Okay.
So I think it's important to sort of speak the language of the world when you're trying to communicate. And so for that reason, I'll leave, once I have, say, Jim Beam, I think that's perfectly acceptable, and I don't try to refine it anymore.
Okay. You mentioned earlier on that a large part of what Paul's internet identity writes about is religion. Actually, I don't think you said that, but you talked about the book dealing with religion. And specifically, it's a sect called the Ulms, U-L-M-S. Now, you, Joshua Ferris, created a long and colorful history to this sect in writing the book. I'm assuming most of that was fiction. I don't know it. And I found it very entertaining, but also, you know, complicated. There's a lot going on. So I was wondering, was that fun, creating that whole branch called the Ulms and researching it, researching how it might fit into actual biblical lore and history?
It was great fun, and it was completely enervating. I mean, it was such a pain in the butt because how do you, you know, I'm not writing a biography here, right? I don't care about these Ulms insofar as they do or do not exist in the world. I just care about them insofar as they serve a purpose in my novel. Well, how do you take a group of persecuted, you know, but possibly ancient religion slash cult people, how do you take this entity and make it believable in a book without killing the reader with biographical information? You know, how do you take that information and make it palatable to the reader, and how do you make it live? How do you make it? These were really tough things for me. And you know, I have some readers who say, you know, the religion, I just stopped dead because it can be thick. It's denser. It's a denser read than when you're just listening to Paul you know, talk about his life. So there was some real, like, rhetorical and just language issues that I had to work out with respect to this religion and making it work within the novel.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that some people might just stop dead, because to me it's like you're either going to find that fascinating and get really into it, or, you know, you can always kind of like read it a little more quickly and move through it. I don't think stopping dead makes much sense.
It's not a master class, right? I mean, I'm
right.
not teaching a graduate class on the old. It's there really to provide the verisimilitude of this sect and how they originated in the Hebrew Bible. When I was writing the book, I was really determined not to write about a cult. I wanted to write about a religion. And I wanted to write about how it is that we as a collective decide what a religion is and what it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And what I kind of concluded was that really to become a lasting tradition or a lasting religious tradition, you had to be rooted in the Hebrew Bible. Christianity is rooted there. Islam is rooted there. You know, even Mormonism is rooted there. And
mm-hmm.
eventually, if you lean for long enough and hard enough on the Hebrew Bible, you tend to get quite a lot of credibility over time. So I rooted this religion in the Hebrew Bible. They come out of a sect called the Amalekites, who are the sworn enemy of the Israelites. and transform them entirely so that they no longer resemble Amalekites at all, but are this other thing. And they represent the possibility for Paul of belonging to something larger than himself. And the question that he has to face, or ask himself rather, is, do I want to believe in this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious what the reaction has been to the religious aspect of the book, other than what people say about enjoying or not enjoying reading the details. But, you know, religion can be so loaded now. Like, do you get reactions from people that are passionate?
Yes, I've gotten some passionate responses, yes. When I go into readings, I sort of scan the crowd and wonder who's going to be upset with me. Mm-hmm. But usually it's fine. But, I do talk about Catholicism to some degree, and I talk about Judaism. And the alms themselves sort of represent certain things about belief and non-belief. And Paul is not a man to withhold his opinion. So I think very often people will, not very often, but sometimes people confuse me for Paul and a novel for nonfiction. Religion does know how to press people's buttons. So they forget about the made-up quality of it, the kind of freewheeling voice that is so essential to a novel that doesn't really have necessarily any basis in fact, and take it very personally. And I respect that a great deal. I mean, I think that the very reason that I decided to write about religion was a certain respect that I had in its direction, even as I struggled to embrace any aspect of it. So I'm fully aware of the incendiary possibilities of talking about not only religions but those who believe in them, and either being dismissive or perhaps even too embracing of certain things. So yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Oh, this is just a stylistic thing that I found really really interesting. In speaking with Betsy, who is Paul's head hygienist, who's a devout Catholic, he often has these exchanges in which his lines of dialogue are summarized and she has full lines of dialogue that are presented on the page. So here's an example from a moment when Paul has been sneaking cigarettes in between patients outside the office. This is from the book. She'd sniff at me like a bloodhound, and then she'd say, "What exactly have you been doing?" I'd tell her, and she'd say, "Why do you feel the need to lie to me?" I'd tell her, and she'd say, "Scrutiny does not kill people. Smoking kills people. What kind of example do you think you're setting for your patients by sneaking off to smoke cigarettes?" And it would go on. And it happens in a few places, I think, in the book, and I think always with Betsy. So I'm just wondering, how did you come up with that? I really enjoyed it. It was almost like she got to be the one who said everything, even when she was parroting back what he had said so we would know.
It was a great deal of fun to write like that, because I could just let him, I could just shut him up, and she could inform the reader of everything that was going on. So there was delayed satisfaction, I think, for, as you're reading through, that what he said is going to be communicated to you, mm-hmm. which was fun to write, and I think it's fun to read. But I also think that the what's going on kind of more thematically is that he really is letting Betsy, who is a devout Roman Catholic, speak her mind. And I often find that when you're talking to an atheist like Paul, they're a little dogmatic and a little insistent on getting their points across. And he has been conveying his point loudly and clearly for the last 50 pages, or 25, the first 25 pages until we meet, really get introduced to Betsy. And at that moment in time, I sort of wanted him to take a back seat and to allow the believer to speak. And I think in that way, you don't have to hear what you know must be his counter-arguments. You're hearing somebody who presents an entirely different worldview than his, and in a way that's not being interfered by him.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. I was reading it specifically from personalities and not from theology, and it's interesting that you say that. I hadn't picked up on that, but I like that she was getting her say. I wondered what you are working on now. Are you writing something now? Or?
Well, really, I'm just sort of drifting between hotels now. I don't have a whole lot of time to work. But yeah, I've started something.
A new novel? Or?
Yeah, a new novel.
Okay. I'm wondering what you are reading right now.
Let's see, what am I reading? I'm reading, I brought on the road with me about 10 New Yorkers that I have been neglecting. So I sort of finish them and leave them behind. And then I'm also reading a wonderful book called The Boy with the Top Knot by Fathom Sangera. It's a good, it's a memoir by a Londoner. Yeah, it's good.
That's great. And then who are some of your favorite authors or influences maybe?
Well, one of my favorite authors right now is Edward Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I just think he's a marvel, and I keep coming back to his stories. The fullness of imagination that he conveys in every story, and certainly in the known world, is so vast and so humane that I think he just sets a wonderful example for everyone.
And my recollection is that he's another really amazing example of that use of detail. I mean, he fills every paragraph with so much detail, but it doesn't ever bog anything down. It's just...
Yeah, well, he has a remarkably easy narrative style. So it just reads so very easily. But then he also has, not only with the detail you mentioned, but he has a wonderful store of idioms in his mind. So he can throw out a little idiom like, I don't have a very good example, but he doesn't seem to end a sentence where I might end a sentence. He adds three or four additional words, something that describes something in an idiomatic way that really just makes you feel like you're in the hands of a great storyteller.
So because the show is for writers, I always end by asking for a little advice for writers, if any advice comes to mind.
Well, I guess I would say that it's really important, as I learned through the course of writing this book, to fail and to recognize those failures as amount sooner or later leading to some kind of success. I think very often that there's a perfectionist streak when writers sit down to write. They have an enormous amount of material that precedes their own writing. Mm-hmm. They have Shakespeare. They have all the novels and poems and stories that they've read over the course of their lives. And when they sit down to write, it seems to pale in comparison. Indeed, it probably really does. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of interesting deception that goes, a self-deception that happens when you sit down to write. You have nothing written, and as you accumulate more and more, it seems to be so very lacking. Well, that's one way to look at it, but if you can imagine over the course of time the way in which these early failed attempts get refined and improved upon, then it really makes those early days much more bearable. And really what it is a process of failure toward the goal of some measure of success. So I really think it helps to keep in mind the full scope of the writing project and not to worry about exactly what happens on a day-to-day basis. This sort of gets nicely summarized by something that Emerson said, "The year teaches much what the days never know." And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind as a writer.
Excellent. That's wonderful advice. Well, thank you so much. Joshua Ferris, the book is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, published by Little Brown. I really, really enjoyed speaking with you today.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on your show.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Joshua Ferris. You can learn more about his work at his website, joshuaferris.com, and his last name is spelled F-E-R-R-I-S. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. You may already know that the 31st annual Burlington Discover Jazz Festival is presently in full swing, May 30th through June 8th. The Radiator is a proud supporter of the festival, which is a 10-day celebration featuring legendary artists like Tony Bennett and Maceo Parker, as well as block parties and more than 100 performances to which the public is welcome. The mission of the Burlington Discover Jazz Festival is to broaden awareness and appreciation of jazz through quality live performances of national and regional scope. Present educational activities that illuminate the art form for students of all ages and backgrounds. That's present, not present. Present educational activities that illuminate the art form for students of all ages and backgrounds. Showcase Vermont and regional jazz. Visit discoverjazz.com for a schedule and for more information. This week's Write the Book prompt concerns titles, mainly because I think To Rise Again at a Decent Hour is a fantastic title. I would love to do an entire show about titles. They are the first words that most of us ever see about a book, and they can prompt a potential reader to investigate further or just walk on by. This week, spend a little time thinking about how you might like to title a piece that you're working on or that you've already completed. Initially, just spend time with the piece without making comparisons with other titles that are out there in the world. And then after that, do a study. Scan titles at a library or a bookstore. Pick up a collection of stories or poems, preferably an anthology or a Best American collection, so that you're studying the names of various writers' works. Take notes about which selections you might want to read based on the title alone. Look for patterns in your own tastes and in what you are seeing getting published. Are you more drawn to titles that include a character's name or a place or a hint of the plot? Do you prefer titles that are quirky, like The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime and Me Talk Pretty One Day, or even To Rise Again at a Decent Hour? Or do you gravitate to more straightforward titles like The Goldfinch and The Bird Artist? Look once more at the piece you're working on and think about how you might title it, given the notes that you've taken and the information that you've gathered by doing your research. And hopefully you'll have some new ideas. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.